Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today, the son of immigrants from Sri Lanka to Britain, was born in northwest London. He's lived in Berlin, Helsinki, San Francisco and Malmö, Sweden. He's worked as a designer, a documentary filmmaker and as a video journalist covering post-conflict areas around the world. He co-founded two technology companies and he's given public talks on new media, storytelling and human rights issues globally. He's won awards for his collection of short stories and his debut novel has just been published to great acclaim. Guy Gurunatne, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. It's entirely my privilege.
So this book is fantastic, In Our Mad and Furious City, and we're going to talk about it in much more detail a little bit later on. But firstly, I want to talk about this tweet, because you issued a tweet a few weeks ago, which went absolutely viral, and it was so beautiful and touched so many people. Perhaps you'd describe the picture and what it said.
Sure. So this was on my... This is so bizarre. This was on my publication day. I went with my father to Foyles in Charing Cross. And for as long as I can remember, my father's been telling me this story about how when he came over in the mid-50s and 60s, he came over twice, but when he came over to this country, he had very little education from Sri Lanka. And he used to just sort of teach himself English. He went to night school as well, but Foyles was for him a wondrous place. He can go in there and actually teach himself English, just pick books off the shelf and learn that way. And for him, I think it was particularly special to go back 60-odd years later to pick his own son's book out of the shelf. So I just tweeted that little moment, the moment he picked up the book and looked at it for the first time. And yes, people seem to like it. You're duped into thinking Twitter's just you and your mates. Yeah. The world got involved.
Well, absolutely, because it's such a heartwarming story, isn't it? And such a wonderful story of immigrant success, particularly at this time when we're suffering all these things like the whole Windrush debacle here in the UK. And to hear of somebody who has really flourished here is absolutely fantastic. Tell me about his journey then. So he came here, taught himself English, really came up, sort of established a home here for his family.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember having a conversation about his experience here. In my teenage years, when I sort of got sort of politically aware and that sort of thing, I asked him questions about, you know, what it must have been like for him in the 50s and 60s. You know, did he encounter any racism, that kind of thing? And just, you know, trying to figure out my own way as well. And his response bothered me a little bit. He sort of said, well, yeah, of course, there was a lot of sort of abuse and unkindness. But I mean, his response was sort of, you know, that's the price I paid for coming here. And it's such a different sort of, I don't know how to describe it, but I wouldn't stand for anything like that. And for him, it was a very different disposition. So for me, it bothered me to the extent that I sort of had to write towards that. You know, getting to know him and his story made me, it sort of really illuminated mine, his path from where he came from to where he is now and providing for his family. There are lots of elements of his story in the book via Nelson, one of the characters in the book. And for me, like, you know, it's a beautiful story and it's wonderful for me to share.
I think maybe at this point, just outline the storyline of the book so that we can then see how it actually does echo his story and indeed yours.
So In a Man of Furious City is set around a housing estate in northwest London. And he's in around the area where I grew up. The events in the book unfold just after sort of a terrorist attack that happens. It's similar to what happened to Lee Rigby a couple of years ago, a so-called lone wolf terrorist attack.
A soldier being attacked.
Yeah, absolutely. So an off-duty soldier is attacked in the streets of London. Riots are sparked because of that event. And the book follows five separate voices and in terms of how they confront extremism and their own proximity to that violence. Each character is told in a specific vernacular and dialect. Three young men, it's written in sort of road dialect, the dialect of young Londoners, people like me who grew up here. Mm-hmm. And two other characters, Nelson and Carolyn. Carolyn's story, she reminisces about her own experience in Belfast during the Troubles in the 80s. And Nelson, who's an elderly character, and this is the one that sort of, I think, is pulled from my father's sort of experiences.
Although he's from Montserrat in the book.
Yeah, so he sort of speaks to his experience during the Notting Hill race riots in the 1950s.
For you, though, you are very much a Northwest London boy, aren't you? Yeah. I mean, totally rooted in this city and in this time. And so all of these wonderful characters coming through the book, I wonder how much they reflect your own life experience.
See, that's interesting, because I remember having an interview and a question came along, and I think the question was baffled by the fact that there are no Sri Lankan people in this book, or names, or any reference to my own sort of heritage. But for me, you know, I can't think of anything more boring to write about than my own experience. I mean, there's a lot of me in all these characters, but that also includes people like Carolyn and Nelson. There's a line in the book about London being a place that you can love, but it won't necessarily love you back. And yeah, that I think speaks to my own experience. I love this place, but it can be unkind to a lot of people. And I think my father's experience and the people I know, those who've sort of struggled and sort of tussled with the city are the ones that are inherently survivors and the ones that sort of have people around them that can help them through. That was certainly my experience as well. But, you know, my own experience is sort of refracted through these voices, and I think that's the most fun as a writer.
So tell me then about growing up in London and how those early beginnings, the son of Sri Lankan immigrants, led you to this point where your Sri Lankan father is reading his son's work in English in the biggest and most famous bookshop probably in the world.
Sure. I mean, I don't, growing up, look, writing, anything in the arts is really not, you know, seen as a route, a path out. And certainly my parents weren't really thinking that I would do anything outside of the realm of, you know, any sort of professional, so being a doctor or a lawyer or a manager somewhere.
It's the immigrant expectation,
right,
isn't it?
Yeah. Right. And I think that, you know, the expectation is clipped from an immigrant point of view to the point where, for me, the things that I was most interested in, literature, art, that kind of thing, just wasn't seen as a path out. But I remember going from Northwest London to, you know, the posh areas of London to sort of raid charity shops like Oxfam Bookshop in Crouch End, for example, which I still do. I go in there and that's where I found all the writers that have meant so much to me. You know, discovering people like Virginia Woolf, Samuel Beckett and Ali Smith even. And take these books back home and read them in Neasden. And while also listening to sort of grime music and that kind of thing, that was my experience. And so there was no sort of separation privately, but consequently my experience of reading and writing has been very private and very closed off. Didn't go through the MFA route or anything like that. Sort of, again, it reflects my father's experience of just teaching myself how I wanted to write. There was no one really to impress in that way or seek validation from. It was a very, very private thing. And it's all quite bizarre, actually, that this has ever gotten published. My father can, you know, pick up the book in a bookshop. But, you know, this has always been a very private thing for me. So for it to be out here is wonderful. But also, you know, I kind of want to go back now and write. Mm-hmm. And my father sort of understands that too. This is a surprise to him as much as anyone.
So your career didn't start as a writer, though. Tell me about your career trajectory.
For me, again, one of the creative outlets for me was through video. I would just tinker with video work and editing, that kind of thing. Sooner or later, I sort of founded a documentary film company. This is, again, my trying to get away from any professional career in management. I wanted to do my own thing and founding a company to then making documentaries and short form video for other companies sort of led me down the route towards human rights stories. I used to then trained as a video journalist at university and started pitching human rights stories to outlets like Al Jazeera News, working with NGOs like Amnesty International and War Child UK. And then getting to travel and seeing the world, did a story in Central Africa and Southeast Asia, that kind of thing. Very far removed from where I started from, but those types of experiences that has really influenced me in terms of the work I am drawn towards.
Because you found that there were various limitations when working with video, and that actually prompted you to move on and set up another company to address that.
Yeah, technology seemed to me that the obvious route to go. For me, making short form videos about heavy subject matter need a lot of context. You can only offer so much context in 3 to 4 minute internet video. The form isn't malleable enough, I guess. And so for me to experiment with the technology around video led myself and my now wife founding another technology company called Storygami, where you can, you know, create interactive videos where you can add contextual information, images, Wikipedia entries, other articles to inform the video you're watching. For me, it was out of the experience of making videos for the likes of Amnesty International, who would offer us, you know, 100-page document about human rights violations, and then we would have to then reduce that to a 3-minute video. It's almost impossible. You can create that sort of emotive engagement, but then what then? Mm. And for me, the use of technology seemed an interesting way to solve that problem. I used to think it was a failure of mine when approaching stories like that. I tended to meander a lot in terms of how I would tell the story. And always used to think, as a video journalist, I always used to need to have a point at the end. But I think the novels I love are the ones that do sort of digress and come back and not so much have answers or offer any answers, but are explorations. And sometimes explorations are enough. You know, that's also, I think, what I've tended to do with writing.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of publishers are very frightened of digital and of the world of tech. And I think that the understanding is that it may somehow take away from the physical object of the book. But I'm more and more of the opinion that it can just enhance it, that the kind of work you're doing, the sort of 3-minute video, perhaps even virtual reality, that kind of thing, can actually run in tandem with a book and really enhance that experience. Is that something that you've experimented with or might, in fact, explore?
Perhaps. Spending so much time in tech, I realized that the people who sort of introduce and innovate around technology are usually the ones that you would expect. And more, I sort of think that if any industry wanted to innovate, I think the tendency seems to be you would wait around for Silicon Valley or any other tech hub to innovate for you. I think more and more, if you were to then begin to see ourselves as technologists ourselves, so as a writer, I also see myself as a technologist. So if there is an opportunity for me to then sort of engage with different forms of storytelling on a digital format, on a digital platform, I think that's okay. And I would hope that other people within other industries would want to have a say. People who have a stake should be the ones that are innovating around their own industry.
I was particularly struck at the beginning that he's running through the estate, how very filmic that was and how easily translatable into a cinematic format.
Yeah, no, I think so. I tend to think in images first, and it seems to be transmuted into the language. I think the language is washed through with many things, and I think imagery is one. I was a film geek before I was a literature one. Mm.
And clearly music is really important to you as well. I mean, that's another point that struck me, was that this novel could have its own soundtrack.
Again, the experience of growing up in London. London to me is language, it's music. The music that seems to have emerged from London very recently seems to be a sort of amalgam of different experiences, of different cultures, different vernaculars. And to me, the propulsion of the language seems to be quite musical. It's what I hear. You just have to get on the top deck of a bus to hear all the different dialects merging.
You're right. You can trace the new music through the old, and you can see the marks in it. And so I guess you're talking about how important music of a particular place is. And you go on to talk about rappers and how you wonder why British rappers are glorifying the Bronx or places like that, when actually this is what's real, talking about London.
Yeah, I think that's a reclamation. It was the case when my experience of seeing grime music develop. The conversations in high school, I think, were particularly about American rappers, Tupac, Biggie, Nas. And then something happened between the late 90s and the early 2000s where people like me and people like the people I grew up started making their own music, sounding very different, sounded like London. And again, I think that was a reassertion in a way that we can do this too, but not only that, we could make our own thing. And that was incredibly liberating. It came from a place of confidence, and that's a different thing. I think grime, for example, is as significant a British musical moment as punk. It's a great thing to see. And for me, you know, that confidence is something I took into writing as well. And again, as well as a reclamation, I used to worry about how that sort of experience is depicted in films and television and other books. Because for a long time, the road dialect that I grew up with was depicted in usually a comical way or a parody. Ali G, for example, goodness gracious me, very funny. But it's a problem when there is only one story that comes out of a culture. It becomes very easy to dismiss any other forms of art that come out of that culture. This is why grime took a long time to be sort of, quote unquote, accepted by the establishment industries. It's a long time before it started winning Mercury prizes and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And for me, it was important to speak to that experience, but with a confidence that I didn't see before, specifically in literature.
Talking about language, as you say, you explore the different patois of everybody. Interestingly enough, never with speech marks.
No.
For me, what it meant was you sort of removed something, a barrier between me and the characters without you signalling, and now he's speaking. You knew he was speaking. You were perhaps even more into the dialogue because it wasn't interrupted by punctuation.
The whole book, I think, seemed quite expressionistic. And so it seemed right to me to get rid of the speech marks and just have a dash. I think I must have picked it up from different books I read. The writing for me, it's all written from first person. It just seemed at odds to me, just instinctually, to have speech marks in there or any much punctuation, to be honest.
Of course, this isn't your first book. You did a book of short stories.
Short stories, yeah. That was really an exercise in just finishing a thing. I've always been writing. I had never finished a project. And so for me, writing a couple of short stories and then doing really nothing with it, but just having the thought that, yeah, I finished a project and perhaps now I can tackle a novel.
Tell me about that.
It was a couple of short stories that were inspired by Chinese internet commentary. It was a strange thing. It was a thing I picked up on the internet where there were websites that translated Chinese internet memes. And they were just bizarre stories. There was one story of a homeless man that sort of was shot to fame just by the fact that he looked like a hipster. And so people would sort of look around and try to find this homeless man. And so the internet meme developed in a way that was surreal, honestly. It turned out that the man sometimes wore dresses, and then suddenly people would hunt this man down. It became quite unkind and disturbing. These short stories sort of followed these memes around and sort of fictionalized them in a way. But again, I released them. They're out there somewhere. And it's strange to even talk about it.
Because you've moved on. So
yeah, it's odd. It's odd. It was a great project. It was fun. And I'm glad it was finished.
Back to this current book, which it would seem to me is life-defining for you. I mean, this is really a spectacular breakthrough. Were you aware of that as you were writing it, that this was something really special?
No, not really. As I say, writing for me is quite a private thing, very closed off from the rest of the world. And even now, it's kind of a struggle to maintain that healthy detachment, I think.
You've been compared, for instance, to Irvin Welsh, and I was very struck by Ryan Gatiss within your writing. It seemed to me that it was along a sort of similar pathway.
Yeah, it's interesting. Irvin Welsh, for me, gives me an opportunity to talk endlessly about James Kelman, because for me, being so inspired by Scots dialect and just the uncompromising way that people like Irvin Welsh and James Kelman just wrote towards an experience that was honest. And it makes me remember one of my favourite writers is Derek Walcott, and he spoke about writing from the margins towards a cultural centre. And for him, it was the English writing tradition. And for Derek Walcott, writing from St. Lucia at that time must have felt like writing from a nowhere place. So he spoke specifically about, for example, the difference between the mango tree and the English elm. He spoke about the English elm and the oak being sort of already attributed with all the weight and the meaning because of the tradition. And for him, he wanted to write about his own experience, the mango tree and breadfruit and seashells and his Caribbean experience with the same confidence as Keats and Byron. I hear that and I think, well, look at him, look at James Kelman, look at Irvin Welsh and Ryan Gatiss. He writing about that experience with that same confidence. So, okay, well, I write about the chicken shop with that same confidence. I write about the chicken shop like it's a church. Like it's a place of refuge for me. London as a place of division and beauty and ugliness, and write about the lives I know that are so vivid. And so if I could write with that same confidence, then I can write language that will feel alive.
I mean, you do say that London is seen by many as a place of sanctuary, but it can be more dangerous than the places that they left.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a thing with my father as well. Like going back to Sri Lanka, he does feel quite uncomfortable. He's a Londoner by now. And going back, he's quite a busybody. Moving around, he just thinks, okay, well, this place hasn't really changed. There's a lot of development in Sri Lanka, but for him, sort of psychologically, I feel like he feels like he's more of in a natural state in London. And again, growing up, I heard about the civil war in Sri Lanka, sectarian violence in Ireland. One of my earliest memories was an IRA bombing around Stables Corner. A B&Q was bombed. I sort of had heard all these stories about places from which people like my father came from and sought refuge and sought a place of safety in this place. And that sort of jarred with me because my experience growing up in a place like Neasden and going to a school that wasn't particularly, it was quite a rough school. So London for me wasn't a safe place. Home was safe, but London specifically wasn't a kind place or a place that I would have ever thought anyone would see as a place of safety.
So, for instance, there is a Muslim character who called Yusuf, and home for him is the estate. His family originally from Pakistan. Pakistan, for him, is absolutely not home. You write that he has more in common with some racists than he does with the people from his own mosque.
Yeah, no, look, one of the seeds for this book was seeing the killing of Lee Rigby and the video that came out afterwards, and some brave woman had just walked up to Lee Rigby's killer, Michael Adebolajo, and asked him to sort of talk about the motives, and he just started talking. But what shocked me was the way in which he was speaking. He was speaking in Ro dialect, the dialect that I grew up in. The clothes he wore, the mannerisms he had, the way he carried himself reminded me very much of one of my friends that I grew up with. That was far too close to comfort. Mm. And seeing that and thinking about how someone like me could ever do something, it disturbed me to the point where I had to sort of write about it. One of the lines is how Yusuf describes someone he encounters at a chicken shop, a freshie, someone on the front lines, he says, at chicken shops.
Yeah, yeah.
Just came over.
And they are the new immigrants who come over on student visas.
Right.
That's the new front
and
line.
And there's a strange identification that happens where if you're from Sri Lanka, for myself, and I encounter someone who's just come over from Sri Lanka, there is a recognition from their side, but not so much from mine. It's something very different.
Yeah.
And there's always, it's a strange thing being a writer of immigrants. Everyone always assumes there must have been some sort of identity crisis for me. Lots of books have come out from, you know, second generation immigrants and first generation immigrants talk about that sort of schism, the crisis of belonging. I never really had that. That wasn't an experience that really spoke to me. Perhaps as a teenager, I thought about it for a minute, but it's not interesting enough for me to explore in a book.
I mean, there's a wonderful line which for me sums up a lot of that in the book when there is a violent incident and people are laying blame at various places. And the line is, it weren't the West, bruv. We are the fucking West. It was you.
Yeah. I remember a line that did the rounds in the news recently. There was an attempted stabbing, I think, at a station. I forget which one. And one of the people who were just standing around, a Muslim guy, I think my age, just shouted out, "You ain't no Muslim, bruv." And that was repeat and repeat and repeat. And there's nothing more British than that for me. And I think that I wanted to give a sense of that feeling and that sentiment in the book. Because I feel, you know, that's what really what it's about. It's what I was trying to speak to when I wanted to explore issues of extremism. It's in a very humanistic way.
And those issues of extremism come across incredibly well. Again, sort of writing about mosques, and you're talking about if you can't speak Arabic, if you have belief, then you can read the mosque, you can understand the mosque. But without belief, it's just art. And what is art, and does it matter?
Right, yeah. I mean, it's funny, like, the killing of Lee Rigby did spur it on, but for me, what was least interesting for me to do was then write a story about a young man that was radicalized. For me, it was more interesting to sort of, okay, take what was concerning me, what was bothering me, and again, refract it through different voices and explore extremisms in different ways and what it is about us that is disturbed. Because you see things like that, and you see young men who perpetrate these things in Manchester or London or wherever, and the initial response is one of detachment. They're monsters. And you're not supposed to identify with monster, but yet I did. I saw Michael Adebolajo and I thought, that's a guy I would have gone to school with.
Yeah.
So what was more interesting is then thinking about what it is about us that was so disturbed, because we're very rarely disturbed by things that we don't already recognize in ourselves. And so it was more interesting to see those small furies, as it's called in the book. We've all done or said things that have hurt other people, where we've transgressed to the point where we've done something that we've never thought ourselves capable of. I was interested in seeing how people confront those little moments, extremisms through different types of fanaticisms. Music could be one, creatively. Mm. People always talk about artists returning to the page with a lot of rage and putting all their work and effort. A lot of the rappers I love are the ones that are quite expressive and angry and channeling a lot of their energy and that anger and rage into creativity. And Arden, one of the characters, is that example. And that's something I think I identify with as well. And of course, you know, sexually, different types of violences, how we're so saturated with extremism, but getting beyond the sort of headlines and underneath the news and talking about extremism and violence in a very, very, very private and intimate way through those different voices. It was more interesting, more creatively interesting.
It's an amazing book, an angry, angry book. How does that affect you when you're writing it? Do you write from a place of anger? Does it anger you as you're writing?
You know, I'm not sure. I'm quite a chill, pleasant person. I don't think you can choose that as any artist, what you're drawn towards. I tend to be drawn towards the darker things. I was raised a Buddhist. I wouldn't really call myself one. But one of the things about Buddhism is that it's very confrontational. You stare down things if they disturb you or concern you. Death, for example, it's a fact of life. It's something that you have to deal with. Your own emotions, the sense of yourself, your thoughts, your actions, everything needs to be, you have to take responsibility. And there's no abdication of any responsibility if you take that path. And I think that's sort of just in my head. So when it comes to certain things I write towards, if they make me feel uncomfortable, then I will write towards them. I think that's just an intuitive thing that I've picked up. I'm not really sure where it's come from, but perhaps being raised in that way has helped that. I'm not particularly angry. If you ask my wife, I'm not all that pleasant while I'm writing. Get quite grumpy, but otherwise I think I leave a lot of that in the work, at least in this case.
Where will you take it next?
Writing a second book, exploring one of the many lunacies of the world, the idea of borders and nationalisms and transgression. Really, I think the more walls are put up, I think it's the job of artists to sort of then speak towards transgression and crossing borders and breaking them down. I think the next book speaks to that. It's also something that concerns me, that makes me slightly angry. I'll write towards that, I think.
I absolutely cannot wait. If this book is anything to go by, the next one too will be completely magnificent.
Thank you, Jordan. Yes.
Guy Gerenet, thank you so much for coming on Meet the Writers. And In Our Mad and Furious City is published by Tinder Press and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.